Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning and welcome back to another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, where I make the boring sound exciting. this is the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff McClure.
And sometimes we know how to say our names.
And sometimes we don't.
Yes, it takes a great deal of coordination with practice over many, many years to say our names consistently correctly. I'm not sure that we're there yet, but we will be at some point. We will be able to say our names.
I have a subject.
A subject?
Yes, that I would like to talk about.
Is it a direct object? Do we have prepositional phrases around it? Any good adjectives?
Well, a is an indefinite, so it's just, or an.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay. All right. So go ahead. Grammatically correct, I'm sure.
A number that only economic geeks like us really pay a lot of attention to, the PCE came in this week for last month.
Personal and consumptions expenditures.
Yes. And in there is a report on the PCE inflation, which is very different from the PMI. And everything starts with the P, but it's kind of interesting. PMI, by the way, for the United States is up significantly. And that's the Purchasing Managers Indicators. It's at 54. Anything above 50 is growth. Anything below 50 is contraction, which basically the people who are buying stuff for companies to put together and sell later have been told, go buy more stuff. Lots more stuff. That's the PCI. But the PCE came in.
The now, PMI. Yeah. Go ahead.
The PCE came in and it has been stuck. The core, super core PCE is what it's called, that takes out the volatile elements. It takes out the things that are like real estate, rents, and so on that are sticky. In other words, they take a long time to change.
I like how economists give their very boring acronyms superhero names like super core. PMI, PCE. Yeah. There's a lot of evil laughing.
The important thing to note is that the PCE deflator, which is the thing that we're talking about, that the Federal Reserve watches very carefully, has been running between 4.6 and 4.7%. And its month to month rate seems to be stuck there too. And what does that mean? In reality, it's a simple thing. Inflation caused higher short term interest rates because A, the market would do it anyway, but the Federal Reserve is giving it some kick to make it happen more so. What we're seeing in the longer-term maturities is a creeping rise in rates, and it's looking more and more sticky. And what does that mean to you? That means, frankly, from my perspective, I don't think we're going to see long-term interest rates come back down to where they were in the last decade. They're going to rise and they're going to stay up for a long time because the elements that generated the extremely low inflation over the last 10 to 20 years have largely disappeared.
And are single, actively being reduced.
So the issue is,
can we throw in what those things, part of the things, the major thing that has kept inflation so tame for two decades is the globalization of our workforce. So if you just look at the price of a television or a tire, for 20 years, it was flat. The easiest place to look was the McDonald's dollar menu. It didn't.
Did you say a tire?
Yeah, tire, inflation, deflation. That's where
and
you check.
And it was flat.
Yeah, you check for inflation and deflation
got
in
it.
Tires.
That's my preferred
inflation indicator, by the way.
Okay, by the way.
Because just, you know, on the other end of that, you've got on the economic side, this other thing, when you replace the tires, that's retiring. So it's better than widgets for explaining the economy.
Anyway, so go ahead with your subject. I'm sorry for taking you on that rabbit trail.
I'm not sure I can remember
where I
was.
I heard you say something about a tire being flat for two decades.
Right.
Go ahead.
So inflation has been level. It's been flat. The tire hasn't been inflated or deflated.
Yes. The attire, meaning clothing, the price of clothing, attire, has been flat to down for two decades, which means a tire has been flat for 20 years.
There are exceptions to that. College costs have gone up at between 5 and 7% during that 20-year period. Medical costs have gone up between 6 and 8% during that time period when inflation has been flat. So if you felt like college is more expensive and that medical care is more expensive, you're absolutely correct. The rest, and there's been studies on it and all that good stuff. Why did we have such tame inflation for so long? Well, it's because you could send it to somebody else who could get paid a lot less to do it. If somebody came in competition with your product, you couldn't really raise the price, or somebody else would make the same product for less by going to China or somewhere else. So we may be seeing another wave of that in 5 to 10 years as automation takes over plants. But for right now, automation is quite expensive to get installed. So we're not seeing products go cheaper, just like at the beginning of the globalization wave where we were sending manufacturing to other countries. It was expensive at the beginning because we had to build absolutely new factories in a foreign land, and then we had to figure out how to ship the stuff back to the States. But the idea was if you did it enough, it'd get cheaper, and people did it enough, so it got cheaper, and that was a constant counterweight against any inflationary tendencies that we had. If you raised your hourly rate for your workers in a factory in the United States, you would then say, okay, I'm going to charge a higher price because I've got the best workers in the world, but they would just send it to China to get made. It may not be the same quality, rarely was the same quality, but it was being made for cheaper, and people like to buy things that are cheaper, I've noticed. So that kept inflation low.
Let me point out something. Make this very practical. If 20 years ago you bought a large flat screen TV to put on your wall, you probably would need to have a second mortgage on your house to buy it.
Well, let's go back to the analogy we were at. If 20 years ago you bought a large snow tire to put on your wall, I'm sorry. No, go. Let's. The television works better
anyway,
than a tire in this. So
and,
go ahead.
And we all remember when they were many thousands of dollars. Matter of fact, when they 4D or whatever it was finally first came out, whatever that meant.
4K.
Whatever.
Yeah, 4D is something. A physics term.
But yeah. Yes. Anyway, I looked at the price of that thing and said, boy, it'd be nice to have one of those, but I don't want to. No, that's too expensive.
Second mortgage, here I come.
And now it's down to a tenth of what it originally was. That is because of two things, automation in China, because the flat screen TV that you look at today will almost certainly be made in China. Now, here's the problem. The Chinese at that point were being paid very little money. They were coming out of the farm and going to work in factories and getting paid very little. Their standard of living was relatively low. It's now high. Companies are backing out of China, and because China is no longer a trustworthy trade partner. And so they have to go someplace else where labor is more expensive, and it's more expensive in China. So the cause of the sudden deflationary or disinflationary, depending on how you approach it, pressure has gone away. So we get back to the point where wherever somebody is making flat screen TVs, which may or may not be China, we can't find a place where we can go where they'll make them a lot cheaper. So as quality improves, something called greedflation gets in there, which is already happening. Corporate margins in the United States are as high as they've ever been since the 1950s and 60s. What does that mean?
They were able to charge more because of inflation. So they did.
That's one of the reasons the stock market has done so well in this supposedly bad economic environment, is because earnings continue to be high. Why are earnings continually higher? Company after company is reporting that they're seeing lower volumes. They're seeing less revenue, but they have higher earnings. That's because they can price their products upward. There's room to price them because their competitors can't take off and run to an undeveloped country and make it a lot cheaper and ship it here and be in competition with them. So what does that mean to you in reality? It means that longer term interest rates will be higher for a long time. It means that if you hold a long-term bond portfolio, the price has dropped quite a lot in the last year, and it's probably likely to do a lot more dropping and not recover until the bonds mature.
No, I want to add a piece to that. Looking 5 to 10 years out, we can easily see how this goes back to a more benign interest rate because automation technology is going to increase dramatically because so many factories right now are being built from scratch.
Yep.
And as they do that, the technology to automate those factories is having a lot of money spent on it. And there's a great demand for it. So there's a lot of competition to get the automation. The companies that are out there trying to build the robots and the drones to make it more efficient to manufacture. They're very expensive at the very newest model. But over time, that price goes down because we're spending so much money on it.
I recently talked to people who have toured both the Tesla plant in Austin and Dell's new plant in the Austin area. And I said, what did you see that was most remarkable about those plants? And they said the lack of people. They're almost entirely robotic. There's people who are supervising and monitoring the robots. But he said in the Dell plant, the parts that they use to assemble a computer come in a truck, and a robot forklift goes out and picks up the boxes and reads the barcode on the boxes and takes them to the right place. There, where another robot opens the boxes and pulls the pieces out, and it just goes through this system, and what comes out on the other end is a computer. And practically no humans have touched it along the way. And so that is the future, and that will lower costs again.
And right now,
but meanwhile, back at the ranch,
initialization of that at the very beginning of it, it's more expensive. It always is, but it's a need. The people that are automating their plants are reacting to a catastrophe in the supply chain. Something that we never expected to happen just ripped that network apart, and it stayed ripped up for a significant period of time, like 18 months. Where the supply chain couldn't be trusted to work for any product unless it was 1 mile away from manufacturing. It is phenomenal that the supply chain has been repaired as thoroughly as it has been, but there's a lot more redundancy in it and a lot more of nearshoring and bringing back the onshoring of our own manufacturing. The United States is now is coming up on becoming the number one manufacturer of computer chips. And why do I say the United States? We still have Taiwanese companies doing a big amount and Chinese companies doing a big amount. Well, because the Taiwanese companies are building manufacturing facilities in the United States. So now it's the United States making it. And when you think about all the other companies that are bringing manufacturing back here, this is why we're seeing manufacturing in the United States growing at a time when everybody's expecting a recession. So it's really, 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 we have this very nice bit of optimistic projections when we look ahead at where we are in automation and where we are in growth-oriented changes in the economy. We're on the cusp of changes in how energy is made in a lot of areas. The nuclear research is getting phenomenally advanced compared to what it was even 10 years ago in safety and in its ability to create energy. I have a story to say on that one here. The Japanese companies are investing in a British Core Power, which is a company, floating nuclear power. It's, in essence, it's a ship that only exists to create nuclear power, and it has never got a lack of coolant. And you think, well, that's dangerous because the nuclear stuff is out at the ocean, and if you have some kind of a failure, the levels of security on that thing, the layers of new technology to prevent meltdowns are fine. Oh, man, they're orders of magnitude better than what we had 20 years ago, but they're still dangerous. So people still look at that and say, oh, well, fusion is coming. Prototypes already exist in multiple sources that have produced more power than it took to start up. What does that mean? It was able to create more power than the energy just to make it run. That means that it's energy productive positive. We've got renewable resource technology is coming up at high speed. Fracking technology is having another wave of innovations on it. That's purely chemical based, where the rest of what we're talking about is mostly physics and safety measures, new materials and so on. So all of that says that in the future, power will be a lot cheaper. When we're looking at automation, same stuff. In the future, almost everything that we use will be less expensive. And we had a trend of that for a long time in manufacturing for cars. If you bought a car over a 20-year period, not that long ago, this last 20-year period, most of the time the car you were getting had significant upgrades from any car made 10 years before, from the way the windows worked to the airbags. And that didn't contribute to a massive rise in the price of vehicles. Why? Well, because we were finding new and better ways to manufacture. Now we've hit this inflection point where Tesla's come out with a completely new way of making cars, as automated as possible. And other people are following. There's another time when we had a massive innovation like this, and it wasn't greatly long ago. And seeing as the studio is based in Temple, this is a great example. Drayton McLean, McLean Enterprises, which is a logistic company, it developed a technology that is ubiquitous today. And that's a database-driven barcode technology, so that when you're buying groceries and they scan the laser on the barcode, the software in the system knows that a sale has occurred and can put its tally up for the next order of that item. Walmart wound up buying McLean's and then eventually selling it to Warren Buffett. So that innovation of how we trimmed back on warehouse space, because you didn't need to just in case have 30 tubes of toothpaste in the back. If you knew that, hey, we have five extra in the back and we're ordering more as it's being sold. So you didn't waste money on inventory that you weren't going to use for a while, weren't going to sell for a while. That was a tremendous innovation in the way everybody did business. It led to this kind of on-time ordering system. The supply chain melted down in the pandemic, which caused us to reevaluate the whole thing. How do we do an on-time ordering system just in time when we're separated by the largest ocean on the planet from the manufacturer? And nobody's in control of which country closes what border at what time. So bringing that manufacturing back increases cost for a while, but then significantly decreases cost. If we replace the labor in a Chinese plant with automation in the United States, that initial purchase of the automation is expensive, but the end result is an even cheaper product. It doesn't have to be shipped for 6 weeks on a ship that the company doesn't own. It's pretty rare. I mean, the chip industry does not own a bunch of freighters. There's freighter companies that do that. So the efficiency loss and having to ship it halfway across the globe has been mitigated by the cost of labor being so low. We'll come forward to today. We're now innovating automation so that the cost of labor has a kind of a balloon price at the beginning and then a flat price going forward, kind of like fracking, kind of like renewable resources. All of that stuff is an innovation to how often you have to invest to get the same result. If you bought a robot versus if you're paying three people to do that job, the robot can work 24 hours a day. You don't have to pay it overtime. If you have a higher demand than usual, you turn on all the robots. No extra expense there except from energy generation. Tesla's also done something fascinating in that they own the power plant that's right next to their manufacturing facility in Austin. So they're their own energy manufacturer, and that makes sense because they deal with energy all the time on the battery end. So of course they would have their own power plant there. It's fascinating to see technology and innovation happening, because when you were a kid and when I was a kid, we were reading about Henry Ford and how he completely innovated manufacturing. Well, we're having another, at least the same order of magnitude shift when it comes to automated manufacturing. And that brings prices down for everyone. The standard of living going up and the prices going down. And I used the cars as an example. Over a 20-year period, the car prices didn't rise even as fast as inflation while they were having airbags put in every possible impact zone and crumple zone technology and more efficient energy consumption in the car, better gas mileage, all across that stuff. We have massive improvements, and we're about to have that in a whole slew of other things, from cereal to, it's already happened in farming. the manufacturing of food is far less expensive. Some quick statistics. In the year 1900, 80% of the United States economy was dedicated to agriculture, 80% of the workforce. You come forward to the year 2000, and it was 2%. In 2020, it was 0.2% of the workforce involved in agriculture. Well, why? Because the combines drive themselves, and the de-weeding is being done more and more by drones. Even the, you know, the barnstorming, flying down and dropping insecticide and herbicides on the plants, has the drones are coming in to do a lot of that at this point. And eventually that gets fully automated. Eventually they have all the coordinates that they need to just hit a button and the thing goes up there and does it. And there's somebody watching it happen. But it used to be a team with a helicopter. And so all of these innovations are good things long term, but they are going to disrupt how we live. That's not a bad thing. We do think most of the disruption occurs in recessions. So adversity breeds creativity. It is written everywhere. You have some other things that you wanted to talk about, though. I've just kind of covered a lot of the things that we're optimistic about.
Well, I'm also optimistic. New home sales exceeded expectations in April, which is interesting. New home sales went from 656,000 to 683,000. No, for the last month in April. Now, why is that important? Typically, when we see mortgage rates rise as much as they have risen in the last year, new home sales just dry up. They fall dramatically, and instead they rose.
Well, they rose recently. We had a drop over the last year.
We had a drop. Generally speaking, when interest rates go up and stay up as they have, and we've also you see the drop continuing. And the other thing is, we're seeing reports all over that lending criteria is tightening.
Yep.
Across the board. So it's harder to get a loan. The loan is more expensive, so of course people are making more loans. They're borrowing more money to buy houses. Wow. And what changed? And this is I dug into this because I thought it was fascinating. Two things that tells us. The first thing it says is there's a lot of people out there with sufficient down payment and sufficient credit to buy the more expensive new houses, and they are doing so. That is a real positive going forward. Now, why is it that there's such a shortage of existing houses on the market? And there is a shortage of existing houses on the market.
Oh, can I answer? People don't want to sell their house and have a higher interest rate on the new house.
The people who own a house and they have a 2% or a 2-point-something% mortgage on their house have no desire whatsoever to sell the house for a whole bunch of money and then go get a mortgage for 7%. It's just, no, I'm not going to do that. The other thing that's causing this to happen, I actually ran into that talking to some people recently. A member of our family sold his house in Austin a few years ago. When did he move to North Carolina? How long ago was that? 3 years ago?
2 years ago. So
okay, it was 2 years ago.
Pandemic move.
And this small house that he had in North Austin, which was a 1940s house that had been renovated, what he got for that enabled him to buy a much larger house in North Carolina. Well, I just talked to some people who just came back from North Carolina and were looking at the price of houses there. And they said the house prices in that area have doubled and tripled in the last 2 years.
That goes to something we talked about last week about the way that inflation migrates and how people with high paying jobs working remotely now in a place that has lower paying jobs around it starts raising the wages of the people around them because they're spending more there, causes some regional inflation. And that's happening in North Carolina.
This is one of those issues that in my 40 years of watching this professionally and 10 years before that as a investor, I've never seen before. We are seeing, normally you say if mortgage interest rates rise dramatically, they double or triple over a 12-month period. That's when we'd get the housing bust and the builders going bankrupt and everything falling apart as far as the eye could see in the real estate industry. Instead, what we see is the builders hiring more people and building more houses. This is one of the things that's pretty fascinating, and which is why I look at the traditional indicators of when we're going to have a recession and say they're no longer accurate. One of the indicators is, by the way, higher mortgage rates indicates a recession is coming. Well, in this case, higher mortgage rates are causing more people to buy new houses.
Right.
And which kinda, is mind-boggling.
To tie that in, when I bought my first house, I was extremely pleased to get a 7.5% interest rate on it. And then the next house I got, I was even more ecstatic to get a 6% mortgage. I've now got a 3% mortgage. But interest rates are where they've been in my lifetime, and they didn't feel constricting. And this is where the Federal Reserve has a term, academics have a term, a neutral rate. It means it's not stimulative and it's not contractatory. How's that for a fun word? It isn't stimulating growth, nor is it creating contractions. That's like the target zone in a inflationary period. If inflation keeps going, they've got to go into contraction mode and ramp back on the ability to grow. This is the fear that we're going to have a recession because interest rates are up. So kind of wrapping that around, the concept of like we compare the housing market. We have more houses being built now. Why? This is a big question. Why? Why are interest rates high and yet people are buying houses again? What's going on there? Well, we don't have enough houses. During the global financial crisis, the Great Recession, the cause of that was overbuilding of houses. Now, you can say something else caused the overbuilding of houses. It's not really one cause of this. But we made a lot of houses that people weren't living in. There were whole communities being built in Florida that didn't have anybody that wanted to live in them. And that caused problems because eventually when people stopped buying them for more than they were worth just because, a lot of houses became worth less than what was owed on them. And the foreclosures were taking off. So a lot of builders went out of business, and then we didn't build much in the way of houses for about 15 years. That means we've now caught up with the excess inventory and we've exceeded it. We have people that wish to own houses that have been saving for half a decade to own a house, and they are looking to buy a house, and they got put on hold because interest rates started up and they said, well, we're going to have to save a lot more than we expected. But they're still coming out to buy now because there's not enough houses, which means that we do expect house prices to continue to decline for the next 12 months or so, but not like a bubble popping, because there's still too many people that want to buy and not enough houses on the market. Now, you might have individualized little frothy bubbles popping in places where there's a lot more building going on than there's a demand for that the housing. But that happens every time. So you might see people just betting on the wrong location. How could we be wrong if everyone's building here? Well, that's why you're wrong. That's because everybody's building there. That's how it could be wrong. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy or reverse prophecy. All right. So I jumped in there in the middle of this and I've been rambling on. I'm waiting for you to, do you have more to say on this?
Well, the important thing I have to say is that the forecasts of a recession are, in my opinion, nothing to be concerned about. And the reason I say that, we are at such a high point in the economy that it's just astonishing. The number of people employed, the percentage of people unemployed, the number of people who are filing for new claims, all say the economy is running hot, which means, by the way, the Federal Reserve may pause this coming month in their interest rate hikes, but I kind of suspect they're going to go up further because they're not slowing things down very much. What we're seeing is reduced growth. And it's guessing at interest rates is kind of a hard thing to do. But one of the things we're seeing is I think interest rates are going to, the short-term interest rates certainly won't stay at as high as they are right now, 5.25, but they'll probably come down only to in the four ranges. Longer-term interest rates then will go up, and that's where we'll get the positive yield curve back. And if you don't, if that's unimportant to you, then that's unimportant to you. But the issue is to be aware of what happens when interest rates rise in a secular fashion, which is what they're doing, and stay high for a long time. When you look at your portfolio, when you look at where you have your money, when you look at what you're planning, are, I have still encountered a few people who are waiting for mortgage rates to come back down to 2% before they buy a house. I think they're running out of hope at this point, but I don't think it's ever going to happen. We've seen a once in a lifetime event. It's not normal. And we have a huge amount of demand in the society. By the way, Moody's is saying that the excess savings, now what's excess savings? That's the money that people, when you look at 2019 and you see the percentage of their income or net worth that people held as savings, cash savings, and you looked at what happened during the pandemic when people were socking away money in savings, and it went up a lot. Well, about 40% of that, quote, excess savings, end quote, has been spent, which indicates that, by definition, 60% of it is still there. Now, it's going to take a little while for the consumer to get back to a comfort level with the economy that will enable them to draw their savings down a lot. But there's still a tremendous amount of money sitting in savings accounts across the United States or in money market funds across the United States that is going to get spent at some point. And as I said last hour when I was talking about where the markets are, you combine that with the rather substantial quantities of money that were moved out of equities and are parked waiting to get back in, and the short interest, the number of short sales that are out there that will have to be covered. And when they cover it, they'll have to buy stocks. And man, I look a year from now, barring some serious major event that isn't economic by definition, it's political or something, I expect a year from now, the economy will be, everybody will be agreeing that the economy is roaring and going ahead, full speed ahead. And I think the stocks are going to surprise us too on the upside.
I agree with all of that. Money supply, one of the things that we track when we're looking at this stuff is the money supply. And the money supply, the M2 version of that, increased dramatically during the pandemic. All that stimulus came in to prevent a depression. And it worked. It even prevented runaway inflation, like what they're seeing in Europe. I know that sounds weird, but the fact that people knew that they had money actually let inflation remain calm. There was less desperation about it than what was seen in Turkey or in even the UK. Yeah, by the way, Turkey's just a basket case. It is really not good to look at the economy of Turkey. We talk about Germany being in a recession. Turkey is, it's going to take decades to recover from what they're going through right now. They're having, the lira valuation is just tanked.
It's at record lows. And if they reelect Erdogan, he probably will continue with the same policies, which means it'll only get worse.
Yes, he fights inflation by lowering interest rates, which caused their inflation rate to go triple digit. And that's in a, you know, we would think of Turkey as a industrialized nation. It may be still slightly emerging, but it's got an industrial society. They have skyscrapers in their main cities. I mean, this is not a backwoods type country. But they caused themselves to have a real banana republic currency issue. And that had to do with bad decisions and the firing of three different equivalent of the treasury secretaries, ministers of the treasury there, before he got one that would agree to lower rates, just basically do whatever he told them to do. And they're in a runoff election now, which is unheard of. Nobody thought he would be in danger of losing 6 months ago, but the inflation has really driven a wedge into his support.
Driven.
Yes. I drived and then drunken it. No.
Well, it is time for commercials again.
It is. If you would like to join our conversation, we have email addresses waiting with bated breath, bated forever because they never even started, at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we will be back on the other side of these very important announcements with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
As you pointed out last hour, I had mentioned volatility being up, and I hadn't meant to say up. I meant to say down. And you said, hey, you said, it's not up. It's remarkably subdued. The reason I was talking about there, and I said it completely wrong, the market is not acting like there's apocalypse over it. The volatility is remarkably up. I should have said down there. The comparison. Sorry about that. I am correcting and retracting that story. Please strike that from the record. Or just go on strike. That works. Volatility is very, very low, which is amazing. It's the lowest it's been since the pandemic started. It's not quite as low as it was pre-pandemic. So why? When we have all this other stuff, it's doom and gloom in the newspapers. We've got a debt ceiling thing happening. Why is the market so calm? What do you think?
I think because earnings remain up. People who are serious purchasers of stocks, of equities, are looking at all the numbers we're looking at and saying, for example, one of the articles relative to what John wrote, his question earlier, is that Microsoft is considered to be a safer bet than the United States government right now. People are buying short-term debt from Microsoft. Microsoft short-term bonds and notes are higher in price and lower in interest rates than they were before the crisis. So people are looking at that and saying all the things we see, which is that the consumer has plenty of money. They increase their spending. There is no longer pressure on the margins of corporations because of somebody who's going to make what they make and then move it to China and be able to make it cheaper than they're making it. That has been part of the economic landscape for decades now, is that if you're making something in the United States, you could be run out of business by somebody who is making essentially the same thing. They're your competitors, but they're making it in China. Now, there's exceptions to that, obviously, and that is you can't exactly have a person in China do the plumbing on your house, which is why services inflation has been so high. But across the United States economy, I think serious investors are looking long-term and they're seeing a lot of health. They're seeing a lot of potential going forward. And so the markets haven't tanked. Matter of fact, they're slowly rising. We go through crisis after crisis and the world doesn't end. And people are gradually moving back in. This is, and again, it is a classic beginning to a bull market, whether only in hindsight will we know whether this is accurate or not. But bull markets climb a wall of worry. And frankly, I would be very afraid at this point if I didn't see a lot of things to be afraid of. When you don't see anything to be afraid of and you're convinced this will go on forever and this is wonderful and your mother-in-law just made a killing on some fancy tech stock or something like that, when you see that, that's when you should be afraid of a major market downturn. I've certainly been through that enough times. Right now, everybody is scared. And they're scared very seriously. I'm, by the way, not at all convinced that we will see, even if McCarthy and Biden come to an agreement, I'm not at all sure that they will be able to sell it to their respective parties in the House of Representatives. The more I've studied this, both sides are, by the way, certain issues they said is a red line. The Republicans say those people receiving assistance from the government to live need to work. They need to go out and go to work. And that's a red line, period. And the compromise is, well, okay, if there's no children and they're able-bodied and the Republicans saying no, and I'm not talking about Speaker McCarthy, I'm talking about individual members of the Freedom Caucus who have said this is a red line issue. On the Democrat side, they've got the same red line.
It's just the reverse
side of the red line.
Yeah.
The people who are receiving assistance from the government because they're poor and poorly educated or whatever, forcing them to have a job before they get any money is a red line to the Democrats. And I can actually see both sides of that argument. I can understand. One of the specifics that I read about in a Wall Street Journal article I thought was interesting is you've got a mother and she's got kids, and they get off school at 3 o'clock and she discovers that no matter how hard she tries to work because of her poor education, she doesn't make enough money to pay the rent and pay childcare. So she stopped working because it was actually going to drive her into bankruptcy if she worked. And if she stopped working and she has the kids, then the government support comes in and she can pay the rent because she doesn't have to pay child care. That's one side of that argument. The other side of the argument is if she, we are giving her an incentive not to work by paying her for staying home and taking care of the kids. That red line, McCarthy and Biden may find a compromise on that. But the issue is whichever side of the red line the compromise falls on is either going to lose a significant number of Democrats or a significant number of Republicans. I want to be very, very optimistic that we will not default on the debt. But I think there is enough polarization in the House of Representatives right now that the distinct possibility exists that we will default on the debt. When I say default on the debt, the Treasury will be forced to prioritize who gets paid, which will immediately generate a huge number of lawsuits, which may tie everything up. And we, this is not a pretty picture. And again, let me put the bottom line on this. I know I'm talking on, but I want to put a bottom line on this. Congress passed laws requiring the Treasury to spend money above and beyond estimated tax revenues. The proper way to deal with that is when they do next year's budget for Congress, and all spending bills have to originate in the House of Representatives. The Republicans have a majority in the House of Representatives, then just lower spending next year and make the hard decisions as to and take credit for the decisions that you make.
And
simply saying cut spending.
And let me kind of give it a bit of rationality to say how much of the budget are we talking about should the work criteria be added, okay? And there are only rough estimates at this point, but economic security programs are the ones they're talking about. That's like SNAP and welfare in general, and it's also earned income credit. The earned income credit, you already have to have earned income. You don't have to have as much as you're getting a credit for. It's called a refundable credit. You can actually receive more than you earned, but you have to have a job to get that. That's why it's called earned income. Then you have SNAP and WIC and things like that. WIC requires a child to be involved. SNAP as well is related to these are benefits given. And then there's unemployment insurance. So if we're saying, all right, so we're just the programs that are economic security, if you put a job criteria on it, how much would that change the budget? And the answer is less than 1%. Less the economic security as a percentage of the budget is 11% of the budget. The change to say some of you aren't working and we're drawing a red line and we're going to destroy the whole system is less than 1% of the budget of the United States. This is the red line that's been drawn by the Republicans. No, we're going to break everything to make that a slightly different version, and the numbers aren't exactly distorted here, but if it's, this is actually a larger number than what's happening at Congress with this area. If you make $100,000 a year and you threaten to stop paying the mortgage, the car bill, and the credit card bills because your spouse is giving $100 a month to the food pantry, and she's not aware if the food that's being given to the recipients has a work requirement. And if it does, then we'd only be giving $90 a month instead of $100 a month. That's the point I'm making, that this is a tiny portion of the budget that is the bottom line, red line I'm not going to bend on.
Let me change your analogy a little bit.
Okay.
You're making $100,000 a year, but your household is spending $107,000 a year.
Right.
And how do you adjust that? Well, the standard and what I would tell people is let's sit down and go over the budget and see where you're spending the money and stop spending so much money. Or get a better job, get more income. Those are your choices. The choice that Congress, at least the Republicans and to some degree the Democrats, they've got the red line too, are saying is the way we reduce our budget is to stop paying on existing debts.
Stop paying the mortgage.
Stop paying the credit card bills. Stop paying. Yeah, it's going to make things worse. And we are out of time.
Yeah. So if you have the opportunity or can make the opportunity, please contact your representative to Congress and say, raise the debt ceiling. I realize they've got principles involved and all of that, but this is a bad, bad, bad thing. We don't want it to happen. We don't want us to default. Man, there's all kinds of English grammatical errors with that, but I think it was correct. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting, real live people during the weekdays, weekends voicemail. You can reach us locally at
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you can read our newsletter, sign up for a newsletter. We put it out on Fridays. You can get our podcasts anywhere you get podcasts. You can listen to our full radio program going back a lot of years on the webpage. You can contact us through the contact form or directly at Jeff and or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.